You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
What you've just described is absolutely the way of working that we try and talk about in terms of the culture of DevOps and transformation leadership. It's not about punishing, berating people. It's about helping people self-discover improvement.
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Membership at DevOps Institute, and this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. And today I am very excited to be sitting down to chat with my colleague Helen Beal. Helen is a DevOps and Ways of Working coach, Chief Ambassador at DevOps Institute, is an ambassador for the Continuous Delivery Foundation, and the chair of the Value Stream Management Consortium. She also provides strategic advisory services to DevOps industry leaders such as Plutora and MOOCsoft. She's an analyst at TechStrong Research as well. She hosts the day-to-day DevOps webinar series for BrightTalk, the Value Stream Evolution series on TechStrong TV, and speaks regularly on DevOps and Value Stream-related topics, is a DevOps editor for InfoQ, and also writes for a number of other online platforms. She regularly appears in TechBeacon's DevOps Top 100 lists and was recognized as the Top DevOps Evangelist in 2020, the DevOps Dozen Awards, and was finalist for Computing DevOps Excellence Awards DevOps Professional of the Year 2021. Helen, welcome to the show. We're going to give you an award for the longest bio, too.
I'm so sorry that you made it the whole way through.
It was fun, though. My goodness. I think you should get the Nobel Prize, too. We'll just add that.
I think it's a wonder I've got time to pee, isn't it?
Well, if you want an award, we'll give you one for that, too. I am jealous. I have to say, you are on a lot, and that's a credit to the kind of person you are and what a great speaker you are. So really appreciate you taking the time out to come and talk to us on the Humans of DevOps podcast.
Oh, well, you're our family and it's my favorite podcast. So, you know,
thank you. You have quite an interesting story. You know, so many people, obviously in the industry, so many people know you, and you're our chief ambassador. So you wrangle the 200 plus DOI ambassadors, which is a job unto itself. but let's get started with you and your career, and maybe take us back to when it all started and maybe the why. I think what we like to do on this podcast is to understand the why. What makes the heart beat, you know? I think that's a great interview question sometimes for people, but it's also a great question on here when we're just trying to get to know you. You know, what's the reason that you got into all this in the first place?
What makes me tick? That kind of like infers some kind of intention. And I think as we work through my story, we might discover there's not an awful lot, but there probably is some kind of purpose underneath it all, I guess. It's funny because I've had to do more of this as I guess we've been doing more profiles and stuff over recent years, and it's brought up things that I'd forgotten. And if you try and, I guess, go back to where this all started, it's like 1981 and I'm seven, and my dad, who's a pilot, so he's really techie as well, gets our first computer. And I can remember it was 1981 because it was a ZX81. I don't know if you remember those, you're probably maybe too young, but they had these kind of pushy keyboards. And I remember being playing it on my own at primary school and playing some kind of game where there were like witches and jungles and stuff. And I'd never really thought of myself as introverted until more recently, but I'd look back at that little girl playing her ZX81 in primary school on her own at lunchtime playing whatever this witches game was. I think maybe I was a bit more introverted than I thought. But yeah, so my introduction to computers was quite early, and then we got a CPC-464, and I was programming using BASIC, and my parents had quite a strong work ethic, and they gave us a bit of pocket money, but it was quite limited. We were allowed to earn extra money by like washing the car, but then my brother got a paper round, and then he subcontracted his paper round to me because he couldn't bother to do it anymore.
And he was a good businessman.
quite a businessman, my brother. He went on to study business studies at university. And yeah, we started working early. I remember working in a greengrocer's, and I think I was about 11, and Simon, my brother, had been about 13, because they used to pay us £1 an hour for our age, and then another 10p for how old we were over 10. So I used to get £1.10 an hour, and Simon used to get £1.30. But there was a great bonus of that job, in that you were allowed to eat whatever you wanted in the greengrocer's, and I always loved fruits. That was great. And also they had bread sometimes as well. And two of our best friends from growing up, two sisters, Victoria, who's still my best friend, and Sarah, her sister, who is now my brother's partner, and they have a baby together. They're both previously married, but it's kind of like, we'll come back to that. The four of us used to work there, and Victoria and I used to just, the bread would arrive fresh out of the bakery, and we would grab a loaf, and we would just eat a whole loaf of bread off it. So yeah, there was green grass.
I think at that age, I would have just worked for food. You wouldn't have even had to pay me. Maybe even still, I don't know. Don't tell anyone.
So yeah, I did lots of jobs, and then I wanted to get a cat. And I was talking to my mother about this recently. You know how memories change with different people. Like, you remember things differently. The way I remember it is that I said I wanted a cat, and my mum said, yes, you can get a cat if you learn how to look after cats. So I said, fine, I'll go and get a job in a cattery. My mum tells it differently. She just thinks I wanted to work in a cattery, which is fine. I ended up with the cat and the job in the cattery. And I worked there for years, from about 13, and actually all through university as well. They paid me handsomely to be the chief chalet maid, so I would go around and coordinate the daily cleans for all the cats that were spending their holidays with us. But the
is that like boarding, like for cats that come
like
to be
kennels,
cleaned?
Yes. And,
okay, kennel. Okay,
exactly, like kennels for cats. So it's where, when you go on holiday, you don't want to leave your cat at home on your own, so you put it in it. You put it in a little shed, basically, and some other people feed it and clean up after it for you, and then you go and get it later.
We just left a really big bowl of food. And went, no, just kidding.
Yeah. It works much
cats better. Are so smart, they could take care of themselves.
Exactly, and they won't eat it all at once like dogs. Yeah. You would just go, that's a very big dinner, I'll have that. So yeah, I worked in the cattery, and it was there that I did, I ended up writing my first thing, which was in Access. I wrote a CRM, basically a customer relationship management system in Access, because we got board of use in the cards, in the boxes. And then at university, I went to university between 1992 and 1995, so quite early on in the internet. And I'd read a lot of books before I went and did my degree, which was English literature and language. So when I got there, I discovered that they had this modular approach, which meant that I would have been rereading a lot of the books that I already read. And I really wanted to read all the new stuff, the modern literature. And there was no real way to get to that. So I ended up with this really weird hodgepodge of modules, one of which was English and computing. And that's where we started to learn about this stuff called HTML and HTTP and the internet. And we did this whole other bit, which I found really interesting, which is about NLP, but actually not neuro-linguistic programming, but natural language parsing. So this concept that everyone has their own idiolect. So you have your own vocabulary of words that you would use, and I have mine, and that we can tell who's writing by the use of certain words. So you can use it to do data crunching and analysis on like one text and say, well, was it Shakespeare that wrote this, or was it Bacon? And that was quite interesting. So got more interested in computing. Also needed to pay my way through university. My parents helped, and there were grants and stuff, but wanted extra cash. So I ended up doing a lot of temping, and nearly every temping role I did took me into some sort of computing organization. Probably the most notable is the one that probably triggered us wanting to record this podcast.
So it was a lot of there was like the data entry, right?
So
let's set it up for everybody. So this was a data entry job. Would you care to elaborate then, I guess, on what were you entering?
We worked in an office which is above the Bally Shoe Shop on a street called Pescod Street in Windsor, which overlooks Windsor Castle. Beautiful balcony outside, and we would
very
sit
elegant.
Very beautiful place. And like, we'd sit at our desks, and this is again probably going to blow some people's minds. We used to work on computers that had chips in them that were 286s. They were very, very early and slow chips. And in fact, and the screens were green screen, right? So there was no GUI on them. It was all just key controls. And we would key so fast that the 286s couldn't keep up. So I do remember that a lot. There'd be a lot of meh when you'd been keying the data in. But the data would arrive in the mornings as stacks of paper. And the paper had been collected from all of the garages, or I think you call them gas stations in American. And at gas stations, you can buy all sorts of different things. But some of the things that you can buy at gas stations are magazines. And some of the data we had was for a specific sort of adult magazine, a whole set of titles of adult magazines. But
pornography.
Also guns. Sorry?
Pornography.
Pornography, yeah. I was trying to use a more acceptable word. But yes, pornography. But also Gardener's World and some other...
of course, it's all together in one big pile.
Bunched together, yeah.
Did you have to sort through that?
We would just go Jester, 5 copies, Knave, 4 copies, and just input the data that way. And then that's how we would know how much to pay the gas station or petrol garage for what they were doing. And we did paint as well. And then there was this classic day when it was a family-owned business and one of the sons decided he would diversify the business. And it seemed like when we got there, so me and my friend Steve met at this job and we're still in touch now. We became great friends, bonded over this experience. But we turned up to work one day and the whole office was full of marital aids. And the son, I can't remember his name, had decided to diversify this business and it just bought
a whole new business line.
Yeah,
just opening up the channels of revenue. Wow, that's pretty interesting. We have never had someone come on the podcast and share something like that before.
And it's amazing what things, you know, what you experience when you go through these careers, these different businesses that you meet that do these different things.
And that's when you're like, I need to do this for a living.
No, and it was a series. So that was one of my temping roles. And there were loads of them. I remember there was a PR company in a barn near Slough that I was at as well. And I think there I was just stuffing envelopes. I remember a lot of envelope stuffing. And I graduated with my English Literature and Language degree. And I'd spoken to a journalist that worked in a pub that I lived near. That I worked in where I lived. And we talked about journalism. He said, well, basically you need to be able to kind of sell your grandmother. And I thought, that doesn't really sound like me. And I looked at publishing and it was very old boys, sort of old school network. And I'd actually been for an interview at part of BBC World Publishing. And I felt it was very, what we call Tory politics, a very right wing conservative politics, which I don't really align to. So I was feeling a little bit like, I don't know what to do. And then this is where the why and the purpose and the intent comes in, or the lack thereof, because I literally thought, do you know what? I'm just going to throw it out to the universe and see where it blows me. And it blew me to this company called US Robotics to begin with. So I started temping for them and we've gotten quite well. And they said, we're going to get your headcount. We'll put you 18 months initially. We'll do 6 months in sales, 6 months in marketing and 6 months in support. At the end of 18 months, we'll look at which one you like best and which one worked best, and then we'll put you there permanently. I said, that sounds good. I like yours, still in Windsor. And they said, okay, we'll go and get the headcount. And then they didn't have any work for me or any budget while they were getting the headcount. So I took another temping role, and that was at a company called Lotus, who 2 weeks before had been bought by IBM for the biggest transaction in history. It was like a $1 billion transaction, which is the biggest. Now we see ones that are, you know, multiples, tens of billions. And I got there and I was there for initially on a 2-week contract while I think a chap called Jez, one of the sales directors, his sales admin was on holiday. I thought, this is quite good. And I thought Lotus Notes is actually quite a lot more interested than rack mounting modems. So I kind of stayed there and just boshed on people's doors until they gave me a job. So initially I got a sales admin job and I kind of noticed these salespeople and they looked like they were having A, quite a lot of fun, and B, earning quite a lot of money. I thought, this looks good. So I boshed down the doors, and the third time around I got my job in sales at IBM. And that's really, I guess, where everything started.
So you went from being an English major. You were doing your own programming, though, on the side, right? I mean, you were doing that early.
That is part of my chalet maid job.
Yeah. and then obviously your data entry job. But then, it led you to the IBM Lotus Notes job. So when you say that you were kind of like bashing on the doors, how were you pursuing it? Like, were you, there was no LinkedIn. So how were you pursuing that back then?
It was all internal. So the first time I kind of stood up and said, I'd like a job. And that I got the like, but you're the temp kind of reaction. And then they were like, oh, okay. And I, you know, I tried to do a really good job. So I kind of, you know, reconfigured the filing system and got some new post, you know, slots in and, you know, made some really big onboarding packs. There was a couple of wobbles. I remember walking in one day, I may have had the permanent job by then actually, but I walked in one day and Rob, my very good friend, said, you deleted the CRM yesterday. Like the whole, and I said, sorry, what?
Just deleted it?
And just deleted it apparently. And I said, well, how on earth did I do it? He went, it's all right, I've restored it now. But I was like, how? I'm just the sales admin. I could even be the temp sales admin. How could I possibly have had the rights in the system to do that? And I actually use that lesson quite a lot with other people because we blame people so much for things that go wrong. But quite often that, you know, like we blame people when they've worked for a bank, you know, Nick Leeson, and they've traded loads of dollars and made a bad trade and suddenly it's all on that person. But it's the system often that's broken. I've seen it in restaurants. Had really bad service and they blamed it on the waitress. It's not the waitress, it's your system.
Are you looking to get DevOps certified? Demonstrate your DevOps knowledge and advance your career with a certification from DevOps Institute. Get certified in DevOps Leader, SRE, or DevSecOps, just to name a few. Learn anywhere, anytime. The choice is yours. Choose to get certified through our vast partner network, self-study programs, or our new SkillUp e-learning videos. The exams are developed in collaboration with industry thought leaders and subject matter experts in the DevOps space. Learn more at devopsinstitute.com/certifications.
Yeah, and or even training. Sometimes, you know, I was actually just talking to my brother about this. He's a police officer, and they have to maintain a certain score with their shooting. And last year he failed. This year he was in the top of his whatever, you know, he had one of the top scores. And it's because he spent the time training. But he's like, the reason he got a low score, I don't even know if I should be saying this on the podcast, so maybe we'll cut this. But he was talking about his drill sergeant in the academy. And he's like, he would just yell at him. And he's like, when he would shoot, he was always bad. He wasn't good at it. It was something he had to learn because, I mean, it's not something you're born with. And he's like, you're doing it wrong. I was like, okay, but great. How do I do it right? So like, teach me. But they weren't teaching. So sometimes it's like, it's training. It's how you're taught. And if you're just not taught and you're just yelled at for doing something wrong, that's not really a way you're going to learn.
Completely. And what you've just described is absolutely the way of working that we try and talk about in terms of the culture of DevOps and transformational leadership. It's not about punishing, berating people. It's about helping people self-discover improvement. So you shouldn't be telling someone they're doing it wrong. You should be helping them discover, you know, what happens if you experiment with turning the gun slightly to the left or, right, you know, putting your right foot forward, but not going, well, you're doing it all wrong.
Here's an example. I used to play piano. This was because, you know, I'm not, I don't know. Growing up in the 90s was a weird period because I feel like you're leaving late 80s, early 90s. It was like there's the way of the past and the way of the future, and they were kind of meeting in one, and it was like some things that were acceptable, which would now you look back and are like, whoa, that is definitely not acceptable. But anyway, I had a piano teacher who used to slap my hand every time I did something wrong, which now you're like, oh my God, that's child abuse. But, you know, back then, I don't know, it was just par for the course, I guess. So it used to slap my hand. It's like, how am I going to learn from that? No wonder I ended up quitting piano. Like when I look back on it, no one was teaching me.
Yeah, totally not allowed now. But I think the more we understand about neuroscience, that kind of behavior becomes quite interesting because what she's created in you is basically a fear response, fear, which is a really bad way of learning because the fear response basically creates a reaction that massively interferes with our frontal lobe, which is where all our cognitive load is happening. So if you're fearful and anxious, suddenly you can't even think straight, which means your chances of learning are massively reduced. So it's, yeah, absolutely not
right, because all your adrenaline's going into being afraid, like the fight or flight.
Completely. It's massive disturbance. Yeah. So it's not a clever way to teach.
Where, no. Did you take psychology? Because I feel
I didn't, but I'm a complete hobbyist around neuroscience and its application to the workplace. And that happened because, like many people in your 20s and early 30s, you have romantic adventures. And I wanted to learn more about what was happening. And I stumbled across a book called Why We Love by a neuroscientist called Dr. Helen Fisher, who then became like the chief advisor for chemistry.com, which is match.com in the UK and probably Europe. And she did loads of MRI scans on people that were in love or had just been just broken up or had were yearning for somebody, and discovered all these different patterns in the brain of what was going on, but also these different hormonal patterns. So what's happening with things like the serotonin and the cortisol. And she discovered kind of the pattern of why humans fall in love and how it happens and what's happening biologically. And that kind of opened the gateway into neuroscience for me. And then early on in my DevOps consulting career, we decided that we would do a breakfast briefing on goals and motivations. And I was like, I don't know what to talk about. And I stumbled across another book by a chap called David Rock called Your Brain at Work. And in that, he identifies what you just talked about. So the amygdala and the fight or flight syndrome, not syndrome, the fight or flight reaction,
the response
and how it happens at work. So it's our lizard brain. It's the most fundamentally evolutionary part of our brain. So a lot of our stuff, our behavior goes right back to it. And he calls it his SCARF acronym. So he has five major motivational styles. So S is for status, C is for certainty, A is for autonomy, R is for relatedness, and F is for fairness. And what he says is like, you have that if you're motivated by autonomy, which I am, and somebody tries to micromanage you, that's the threat. And that makes you want to fight or flight. And you get that reaction at work. And there's so many applications. You know, we just talked about learning around it as well. And we're discovering so much about the brain all the time at the moment. It's like this great mystery that's unraveling in front of us. It's so exciting.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, that's a defensiveness, right, that everyone has when you're being micromanaged. The first impulse is to be defensive. And that's the fight or flight.
Yeah,
I was a psych minor, and I am the son of a therapist and grandson of a therapist, and everybody in my family is way too analytical about everybody else, but it's so funny for me to on these podcasts learn that there are so many principles of psychology in DevOps. And I'm taking DevOps Foundation right now, so I'm learning even more.
Yay.
But yeah, so it's interesting because I can imagine that must be helpful in your career to know about these principles.
Absolutely, and you should take DevOps Leader as well, because we put even more psychology in that. We've got like the Kilman's Thomas Kilman's conflict model. We've got the drama triangle. We've got all sorts of stuff in the DevOps Leader course that you'll find really interesting. And I think that's one of the things that I've really loved about DevOps, and I think a lot of people have in the technology industry, in that it feels like one of the first times we've been allowed to talk about culture. And culture is created by behavior, and behavior is psychology. It is ultimately the brain. So we are having these conversations about these analytical, as you say, conversations about what actually makes us tick and why we react and operate in certain ways, instead of just talking about the bits and bytes and technology. And it's incredibly helpful about getting conflict out of the workplace, making the workplace more purposeful and more joyful, because we're allowed to have these conversations. It's not all about just do your work. It's about, you know, let's all do the right work in the right way and enjoy it at the same time.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit with Lanye last week, about how, you know, in the military, she couldn't really talk about, and really in your career, you can't really talk about yourself too much. You don't really get into the self. It's more, you know, you as whoever, what I am this title at this company, and that's who I am in that moment. And it's like, but that is so far from the truth. We are all individual. We are all people. And I think, yeah, it's important to get to know what makes people tick, because then you learn how to work with them, or you learn what motivates them, and it's so important. And hopefully when we break down the stigma of mental health and just, you know, the what makes people tick, I think sometimes scares people. I'll be honest. I think that's scary to some people.
And I think I'm going to propose my thought on why that is for the first time. I think we're just not used to doing it. And I think it's about vulnerability. It's about, you know, if they show us them, then I'm going to have to show them me.
Yeah.
And we're just not used to feeling trusted in, or having that trust to be able to be, to show ourselves that openly and transparently.
That's what I love about this podcast, is that sometimes we'll randomly get into this topic, and I feel like we could spend forever on it. So, you know, because this podcast is about that. This, I think, that's what I think we're finding, is that this is the safe space to talk about those issues and talk about yourself. And, you know, one other thing this makes me think of is, I guess, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but for DevOps, the human side, I think a lot of times what I hear is like soft skills. And I think that is the worst term, because soft skills to me almost implies that it's easy. And I think soft skills in many ways comes harder to most people, at the ability to understand what makes someone tick, the ability to reach out to someone who maybe believes in something differently than you, to see the world with a different lens other than your own. It's very, very difficult.
And I think we stopped calling them soft skills a couple of reports ago because of exactly these conversations that me and Evelyn and Jane had. They're not soft somehow devalues them. And I think we refer to them as human skills because they are so important. And actually, one of the interesting things that's happened in the DevOps recruitment space is that most people you ask, if you ask them if they want to hire on technical ability or the ability to empathize and work as a team, they will choose the ability to empathize and work as a team. It's so widely recognized that the ability to be able to collaborate with people and work alongside people is so important. And we know the technical skills could be taught, but it's very difficult to teach empathy, I think. I suspect there are things that can be done. I don't think team building is probably the way to do it. I think it needs to be more fundamental than that in terms of, as you say, creating safe spaces, creating psychological safety and giving people the time and the permission to get to know each other. And perhaps that's part of it as well. People feel that getting to know each other isn't work. So they shouldn't spend their work time doing it. They're not getting paid to discover how many children you've got or what you like doing at the weekend.
Yeah, I wonder what, you know, the pandemic and working from home has done to that. You know, I think in some ways we're talking about it more, so maybe it's helped, but it's also created an environment where not only are you on your own all day, and the connections that you make through Zoom, sure, you know, those are connections, but they're not the same. We have less water cooler moments. We have less, you know, in the lunchroom conversation. And I wonder what that does to, you know, maybe not you or I who have already had the experience of working in an office and we know how to make the connections and it comes naturally because you know you need to talk to someone in order to be able to work on a project with them. But to someone who may be new in their career, I often wonder what that's going to do down the line. Like if you go straight into working remote, I'm just curious because it's such a different world to come into.
I agree with you. And I think you've made the point exactly there that we've got established networks. So I talk to the same people most weeks. Occasionally new people come into my life, not nearly as much as they would have done if I'd been traveling around and going to conferences. But every time I talk to one of the people in my network, we consciously spend time doing a bit of bonding, talking about what's going on in their lives, what's good, what they've been up to. But for somebody that hasn't got an established network, it must feel very lonely, I would think, and more difficult to have those conversations with people that you're only just meeting now, that you're going into a new workplace. So yeah, I really hope that the younger people that are in that process of building their networks do get more opportunities to do more face-to-face time, because I think it is a lot easier to do that empathetic bonding when you're in the same room.
Definitely. So, you know, we're coming close to the end of the podcast, and I hate for it to end because I feel like we could talk about this all day. This has been a really fun conversation. You know, what excites you for the future of DevOps right now?
got to be value stream management. Anyone that knows me will know that those words were coming straight out of my mouth. I mean, for me, it's absolutely the next evolution of DevOps. It, as a DevOps coach and consultant, when I discovered it, unblocked so many problems I was having with DevOps, particularly around being able to see around the life cycle and understand where all the delays and the problems were and justify to people why we needed to make changes. And you know, I'm sure I'm allowed to do a plug. The
Absolutely.
DevOps Institute has just launched, in partnership with the Value Stream Management Consortium, the first Value Stream Management Foundation course of its type. It's focused on digital value streams. It's been out just over a week. We've had quite a few certifications go out the door already, which has been very exciting and lots of great feedback. But yeah, for me, this is a massive game changer. DevOps is basically the toolkit that we use to unlock all of the value in the value stream. So the two go hand in hand, but it just takes our 10, 12 years of DevOps thinking to another level in my mind.
Awesome. Helen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us. Like, what you already shared, I think, something that we might not have known about you before. So I'm not even going to ask that question because I don't know what else you're going to pull out. And this has been a great conversation, and I can't thank you enough for coming on. And I hope you come back, because I think we have a lot more to talk about.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to. Once you've done DevOps Leader, let's do another one about the tools in there.
Yeah, you got it. I could talk about this stuff all day. Well, thank you again. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this episode the same as I always do, encouraging you to become a premium member of DevOps Institute to get access to even more great resources just like this one. Until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human. Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.